Imperial Leader, the life story of the foremost man of our time, Winston Churchill. February 1938, and Neville Chamberlain, pursuing his policy of appeasement to the dictators, has begun to divide Parliament into two groups. Those who support him and those critics of his policy who demand a strong front to the dictators. Chief critic of the government is Winston Churchill. And when Anthony Eden is called upon to resign to further appease Mussolini, Churchill speaks out with all his own virility and power.
What is there ridiculous about collective security? The only thing that is ridiculous about it is that we have not got it. If a number of states were assembled round Great Britain and France in solemn treaty for mutual defense against aggression, if they had their forces marshaled in what you may call a grand alliance, if they had their staff arrangements concerted, if all this rested, as it can honorably rest upon the covenant of the League of Nations, if that were sustained, as it would be, by the moral sense of the world, and if it were done in the year 1938, and believe me, it may be the last chance there will ever be of ever doing it, then I say to you that you might even now arrest this approaching war. Then perhaps the curse which now overhangs Europe might pass away. Then perhaps the ferocious passions which now grip a great people would turn inward and not outward, in an internal rather than an external explosion, and mankind would be spared the deadly ordeal towards which we have been tagging and sliding month by month.
Words of warning which go unheeded. Everywhere, critics and enemies of Winston Churchill give vent to their feelings. Lloyd George, an old friend and colleague, brings Winston news of one such attack.
Winston, have you read this attack on you in the latest issue of the Aeroplane?
I'm so used to being attacked that I don't even bother to read them now, David.
But this will probably carry a bit of weight. It's written by Charles Gray Gray, the Aeroplane's editor, who's supposed to be something of an expert on aviation.
Yes, he's also supposed to be something of an expert on the Nazi movement. Now, what does he say this time?
He's referring to a suggestion that you be appointed Air Minister in place of Lord Swinton. This is what he says. We can well understand that such an appointment would be received with joy by the enemies of Germany. Mr. Churchill has consistently played in Parliament the part of the fat boy in Pickwick, in that he has already tried to make our flesh creep with his silly tales about the war might of Germany, and especially of the German Air Force.
Well, interesting.
Disgraceful. The man ought to be suppressed.
It's a compliment, really. Especially when he says that my appointment would be received with joy by the enemies of Germany. Apparently, Mr. Charles Gray Gray is one of the friends of Germany. They seem to be fairly common in this country at present.
Then let's get out of the country. For 1 week, anyway. We're invited to Cannes.
Oh, Maxine Elliott?
Yes. And our fellow guests are old friends, the Duke and Duchess of Windsor.
How marvelous. I'd be delighted to see them again.
It's the first opportunity either of us has had to pay our respects.
Yes, yes. They'll want to hear about things at home. Oh, did I ever show you the portrait he gave me, David? Look,
Edward.
He gave it to me on that last day. We had a farewell lunch together at Fort Belvedere. I left in tears. And he came running after me, calling out, Winston, you've forgotten something. It was this signed portrait.
You've written some lines underneath. Read them to me. I can't see.
Marvel's lines to another king who lost his throne. He nothing common did or mean upon that memorable scene. I'd be glad to see him again, David.
The peace of Southern France and a holiday, perhaps the last holiday for Winston Churchill, before Europe echoes once again to the crash of Nazi jet boots, the whir of a gigantic military machine. So, while Winston Churchill spends a brief respite at Cannes in Central Europe, the Austrian Chancellor has been summoned to Berchtesgaden.
Germany will not tolerate such a situation any longer. Listen to this, Dr. Schuschnigg. I complete a brief separate Austria from Nazism. That is portion of your speech at a newspaper interview. It is typical of the attitude of you and your supporters.
But, Herr Hitler,
may I point out... I tell you the patience of Austria and Nazis is ended. Unless you accept a settlement, there will be a far worse outbreak of disorder and revolt than there was in 1936.
We shall certainly see that such disorders are kept under control. Our police force are strong enough...
Listen, Doctor. If there are any further disorders in Austria between your government and the Nazis, we will march.
You mean...
I mean that we cannot resist any longer the appeals of downtrodden Germans in Austria. On the tables are at home. You must accept them.
I refuse to accept them until I have discussed the matter with President Miklas and members of the cabinet.
But savage anger is aroused in Germany at the thought that Hitler may be robbed of one of his greatest ambitions. Again comes the crash of jet boots. The rattle of sabers.
Listeners, stand by. Dr. Schuschnigg will now address you.
People of Austria, the German government sent President Miklas an ultimatum that unless my government agreed to the German proposals, German troops would march into Austria. I declare to the world that all reports of workers' unrest in Austria and blood flowing in the streets are complete fabrications. President Miklas has asked me to inform the Austrian people that we yield to a superior force. We have ordered the Austrian army not to offer any resistance and to retire because we do not wish to spill any German blood. General Schilhavsky, who is entrusted with the command of the army, will give all necessary orders. So I take my farewell of the Austrian people in this hour. God protect Austria.
Gentlemen, we are met here in conference to discuss our attitude in the light of recent events. Mr. Eden's resignation and Hitler's march into Austria make it now vitally necessary to form a common front against appeasement. We few rebels, as we have been called, must apply all the pressure possible on the Prime Minister to prevent him from making any further concessions to the dictators. I will now call on that distinguished tailor and statesman, Sir Roger Cheese, to express an opinion.
Mr. Brecken, gentlemen, I believe it would be in the best interest of the country if the Prime Minister would delegate the reconstruction of the Navy and its air service to Mr. Winston Churchill. Mr. Churchill's vision, energy, drive, and experience are unrivaled. His appointment as First Lord of the Admiralty would be welcomed on all sides.
I will now ask Mr. Churchill to speak.
my friend, and you are only my only political friend these days, let me give you a warning drawn from our recent experiences. Very likely, this immediate crisis will pass, will dissipate itself, and calm down. After a boa constrictor has devoured its prey, it often has a considerable digestive spell. When I look back upon the last 5 or 6 years, I discern many lost chances when we could have made a stand, a united stand against the dangers, and when, by an act of generosity and magnanimity, following upon the marshalling of material strength, we could have perhaps prevented the evils which are now upon us. But all that is past, and it is time at last to rouse the nation. Let the call go forth ere it becomes too late. To arms! To arms! It is the cannon's opening roar.